following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, you know what time it is. It is the best Tuesday you've had all weekend. It's time for the True Wealth Radio Show. I am your host, Dave Littleton. In studio with me,
Matt Dixon.
And Matt, you've come back to an Arctic wasteland.
Yeah, Hawaii was warm. Oregon is cold.
Yeah, I make this habit of never saying where you're off to when you're not here because I don't want someone to case your house.
Right.
But and the real question is, why did you come back?
That's a great question. That is.
It sounds like parts of the trip were fun, at least.
Oh yeah, the whole thing was a blast, honestly.
And you were which island?
Maui.
All right.
When we landed, though, we landed in one of the worst storms that Maui's seen in like 30, 40 years.
We landed in the storm.
We did. It was like a 60-mile-an-hour crosswind for the plane. Landing was super rough. The plane was jumping all over. The brakes were locking up. It took us 2 hours to get off the tarmac because the flights were so far behind. They had a hard time getting hooked up, getting people off the plane.
That's nuts.
Sideways rain. Kihei was completely flooded with mud. Cars underneath mud. It was horrible. But I was surprised at how quickly the government workers were able to get everything cleared.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. It was a really, really bad flood and landslide type stuff. So it was nasty to start the trip, but it cleared up pretty quick.
All right. Well, I'm glad that part, I guess, get it out of the way.
Yeah.
Right?
We timed it just right. Show up, it's a storm, you wake up the next day, and it's kind of starting to blow over.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Because, you get in the middle of the trip, and it kind of, wrecks stuff.
Yeah, if you had to witness that while you were there, that wouldn't be fun.
Yeah.
Just sitting in your hotel room with nothing to do.
So it's yay, Hawaii.
Right.
It's just like anywhere else except, palm trees when it rains.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Awesome. Well, we're glad to have you back.
Yeah.
Plenty has happened. It's funny. You look at the just radical pace at which stuff has been evolving since administrative handoff in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to avoid talking about this. I do want to say, I'm not trying to come at this from a partisan perspective of your team, my team kind of stuff. It's tempting to do that, right? Because especially where we are in Douglas County, generally leans right. And so I guess it's kind of an easy lob there. But I think it's just really wild how many people I have talked to recently, and it's just, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? And the answer is a very sort of, shrug your shoulders and go I'm not sure. Whatever it is, it's happening fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, we have had already tariffs on, tariffs off, tariffs back on. We've had discussion about radical changes in Middle Eastern policy. We've had radical discussion about domestic energy policy.
Mm-hmm.
We have had radical overhaul of government agencies already, right? I think the first of which really started to roll out was the USAID programs
basically got canned.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, 10,000 workers reduced down to 400. You basically got rid of the program.
Yeah. So I want to do the math on this. I don't have I'm going to pull up a calculator to do it. We've talked about the Pareto principle before, right? But have we talked about Moore's law before?
I don't know that we have.
Moore's law, sorry, I'm confusing these two. The square rule, okay? So Moore's law was the one where it's how computers get exponentially faster, and so the pace of growth just keeps going and going and faster and faster.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that theory of how quickly things can escalate. But how many workers did USAID have?
10,000.
All right, so 10,000. So what you do is you take 10,000. I'm doing this now. And you just take the square root of this, okay? And I got to be able to look at my own calculator to do it. So 100, mm-hmm. right? So here's the crazy thing. The theory of the square is that 100 people in that organization would be responsible for 50% of the work. The remainder do the other 50%.
Yeah.
So you take the square of the number, right? So if you have 100 people in an organization, 10 people are doing 50% of the work, the other 90 do the rest. But 10,000 people, it's only 100 folks. And so right. you said we kept 400, and some could argue like you maybe even kept too many by that rule. We saw it happen with Twitter.
Yep, Twitter's still running, and he laid off what?
80% of the people.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I'm not trying to make a quality or quantity or judgment call per se, but saying by the numbers, there's a good chance that a bunch of folks in an organization of that size aren't doing a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the cuts may have been pretty indiscriminate, but when I look at the programs that were being cut, there's a lot of them that I question.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of fluff. We know that there was. And so they're scaling back on it, and over a long period of time, you know, what's the ultimate goal? And I think it's lower the expenditures.
Yeah.
The government's spending a ton of money, and I think Trump is really, you know, trying to change the way that we look at government, right? And trying to analyze it and look at it more like a business than just an entity that taxpayer money comes into and then money goes out of.
Yeah, I think that's a really astute observation. I had a funny thought about this myself, and it was from the perspective of sitting on some nonprofit boards, which I do sit on, right? Mm-hmm. And the job of the board member of a nonprofit is a fiduciary position.
Mm-hmm.
But fiduciary to whom, right? And I believe the answer is the fiduciary to the taxpayer. Reason being is, like a nonprofit, they don't pay taxes.
Right.
Right? Okay, well, why do they not pay taxes? Because there's some kind of agreement that they're providing a service that benefits the community in such a way that we don't need to tax them because of the community's benefit. So it's like a direct service, right? So that scenario requires some oversight, though. So you get community board members to come in and oversee that. And in essence, it's representing the taxpayer. Okay, that's sort of my take on this. And so imagine you're Elon Musk and you're looking at this and stuff, and you're saying, well, I want to go through the budgets and look at this, but let's make sure the taxpayer is getting the bang for their buck. Right? They're viewing the taxpayer like an investor or somebody that needs to receive a return for their tax dollar.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really different philosophy than I think some people take into the way government operates.
Right.
And so that the business comparison, yeah, I think that's the world that Trump operates in. And so it certainly makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I mean, why else would he propose a sovereign wealth fund unless he's trying to turn the government more into a business? Like, there's so many different things that you can point at that he's doing behind the scenes, and it all starts to triangulate around the fact that he's trying to figure out a way for the U.S. government to make money. And it makes sense because he's a businessman. That's what he's focused his entire life around, is how do I make money? How do I be successful? What's the next, you know, adventure? And I think he's starting to bring that to the government level.
Yeah. You know, we didn't talk about this in advance, but you made me think of this concept. A lot of folks talk about especially when you get into things like democratic socialism, okay, mm-hmm. which is a government form that I don't know that it really exists, but it's been sort of rumored to exist in some of the Scandinavian countries.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the countries that often gets sort of brought to the top of the list is Norway.
Yep.
And they say, well, look at Norway has these really high tax rates, but look at all of the services that everybody enjoys and look at how this works. But is often failed to be mentioned at the same time, though, is Norway has a massive sovereign wealth fund.
They do.
Massive, right? And so because they have all of these oil reserves and these mineral reserves, and so it's something like I mean, it's $50,000, $60,000 per person per year of sovereign wealth supplementation to that equation. So you can have tons of social services because you have sovereign wealth in excess of the GDP of your tax base.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a fascinating concept. And I don't know all the exact numbers in Norway. I just know that sovereign wealth is a serious capital offset. And people don't like to talk about that. It's like, well, what happens if your country doesn't have a sovereign wealth fund? Then how do you deliver social programs at that scale?
Well, you just borrow to do it. And that's what we've been doing. We just keep borrowing and kicking the can down the road. And I think Trump is at a point where he's like, well, you know, he even said yesterday that his hope is that when he's remembered as a president and for all the things that he's done, that he's able to secure that section in Gaza and turn that into something that is profitable for the United States. That was his words. And you look at Netanyahu, he's behind it. He wants to give the Gaza Strip over to the United States. He said it. And so between these two, look at what they're saying. They want to turn that area into a peaceful spot and rehouse all the people that were there. I mean, if Trump was able to pull that off and the U.S. was to start making a ton of money on the tourism to that area, I mean, that's a pretty substantial thing to be able to lay claim to.
Yeah.
I mean, at this age, it's not about money for him. It's about how are you remembered and what's your legacy.
Oh, yeah, I think it's legacy building concepts.
It's 100% what he's doing.
You know, if you have a giant ego, you're like, well, then how do I, you know, etch my name
exactly.
in history?
You do stuff that's never been done before, and the U.S. government's never operated like a business.
Yeah, not categorically, that's for sure. And you know, at this point, it's just a theory. Right. But it, you know, you kind of got to look at it and go, but if the shoe fits
and the shoe does
and the shoe seems to fit, you know, I'm not convinced that Gaza is the pathway already. But, you know, there's things that have been said like, look, let's come back to this. Like, we got to grab a break because I'm just looking at the clock. But what are some of the things that have already been said that suggest that Trump is trying to make us more like wants to change the way the revenue operates in the country, like wants to change taxes, lots of stuff. Okay. But let's grab this break first. So we will be right. All right. There's the music. So we'd be good. All right. Stick around. When we come back, we'll unpack that and more. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where Matt and I are talking kind of about a different angle rather than looking at the whole, it's been less than a month here, and already the government is just, like Trump's aggressively launched a bunch of new policies. And Matt, I think you really have astutely pointed out that he's operating like a businessman, exactly 100%. Like he has been.
Mm-hmm.
It's different than his first term.
Yes.
And so you were talking like the concept of sovereign wealth funds and like the United States generating revenue for the government, or the government actually being able to generate its own revenue in a sense.
Yes.
Right? So how do... My question is, like, how does this play into some of the comments that Trump has made about trying to get rid of the IRS?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I mean, the IRS is a huge entity, right? It's a lot of government jobs. And I think that the ultimate long-term goal is to scale back the type of force that we need to enforce taxes, right? And if we can simplify the tax code, and if we can simplify the way that money moves through the system, it becomes more efficient and it costs less. And I think everything that you're watching him do, even down to, I think he said he wanted to get rid of the penny, like quit minting the penny.
I think they did suspend the penny.
Right? You know. So like everything that he's doing is an attempt to lower the cost that the government has to produce the results that it needs in order to keep a civilized, you know, group of people moving in the right direction. And so the IRS just loops back into that. It's like, well, how do we simplify this thing to where it costs less for the government to run it and we still get the amount of money that we need? And I think part of the tariffs, part of the sovereign wealth fund, it all is pointing back in the same direction of we need to bring in money so that the taxpayer isn't as burdened. And if we can effectively either lower the tax rate or keep it where it's at and the country goes, you know, more net positive than net negative, you're going to start to see a trickle effect that benefits not only the government, but also the people.
Yeah. When I think about the economic forces at play here, like not political forces, but economic forces, right? You know, so what the Fed is trying to sort of, I'll call it manipulate because it is, you know, they're trying to alter interest rates and they're trying to direct policy so that certain behaviors and outcomes happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you think about what are some of the things that are push me, pull me in the economy, right? Inflation and deflation. Those are big push or pull events, right? So tariffs, inflationary. Yep. But driving down energy costs, deflationary.
Yeah.
Right?
Tariffs are just more of a leveraging tool from the way I look at it, right? Because you can look at some of the stuff that he's negotiated behind the scenes with Mexico by using tariffs as a leveraging piece.
Yeah.
And it's like they're already now flying some like F-35 jets that have all of the infrared tracking and stuff to make sure that the cartel isn't moving in numbers across the border. Like, and a lot of the security is being supplied by Mexico. So you threaten tariffs and you get a net positive outcome because now your border's more secure.
That's been my position on this too, is that these tariffs are instruments that force renegotiation of deals that Trump perceives as unfavorable. Let's just, you know, use those terms. And, you know, because great, that's subjective. You guys can disagree or agree or whatever. But yeah, I mean, so you use that as a blunt instrument to get everybody to the table to start talking. And if they don't want to come to the table in good faith, then you go, all right, then we'll really do it, right? And I think that's kind of the issue, is that this, I don't know how many things are negotiated in good faith anymore, because I think there's been a lot of politicians that have sort of viewed America as unjustly wealthy because it's been exploitative, and therefore it needs to sort of make amends by being net payors and rather than being sort of on balance. And you just see that, you know, my impression, right? And I don't have all the data in front of me, but my impression is that there are oftentimes deals that are sort of, they're not equitable deals. It's like, well, hey, you know, we'll provide this, you'll provide us this thing and you'll get five times the value on the other side from us.
Mm-hmm.
And people go, well, yeah, but you know, we got to help people grow or this, that, and the other. And I look back and say, you know, the Marshall Plan post-World War II, the United States was 95% of world GDP at that point. If you didn't help rebuild the rest of the world, you'd have no trading partners, right? I mean, that was a fiscal decision too. I mean, it was an economic decision to say, let's rebuild our trading partners and put ourselves in strategic positions. But I don't know that we're rebuilding right now in a lot of places. So the investment looks different to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that makes sense.
Yeah. So I do think the concept, though, of, you know, I've heard even like eliminate the IRS. That to me sounds like fiction.
I think it's possible, but I think the only way that you can do that is to basically have like an automatic withdrawal from people's pay, where it's like, you know, the money gets kind of siphoned out at a certain rate. And you would have to just completely change the tax code, and it would have to be like an automatic draw, and there wouldn't be tax refunds. There'd be no filing at the end of the year. And I mean,
yeah, but so here's the question. How does that square with the idea that AI is taking so many, potentially taking so many jobs away, that there's discussion about the need for universal basic income because people...
I didn't want to mention it on air because I know it triggers a lot of people, but I think that's kind of what that sovereign wealth fund's ultimate goal is. Right, like Elon Musk has hinted at this before, that AI will eventually take so many jobs that people are going to have to kind of be supplemented. And I think if, I mean, we all know that Elon is largely in Trump's corner and doing things actively in the government. He's trying to get access to the Treasury Department's confidential files right now. The judge halted that. But, I mean, Elon's really, really deep into this thing. And if his core belief is that at some point that Americans are not going to be able to make it on their own without a supplement, insert the sovereign wealth fund.
Yeah, and that's a whole show in and of itself.
It is. That's why I didn't bring it up. But
yeah. Well, because like, the sovereign wealth fund, you know, let me just save everybody the panic, okay? It doesn't have to be handing people cash when that oftentimes results in kind of malfeasance with the cash, right? As we would suggest, like, and I'm just saying, like, look, if a taxpayer is giving somebody else money and then they go spend it on things to break the law, that's malfeasance. And you could say, well, it's free country. It's their choice. Like, we have laws, whether you like them or not. We're all in this social contract. There are laws I don't like. I still follow them, right? Because that's how that works. But there's some folks that just can't be bothered with that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to give them money to have them then flaunt the system, it's like, nah, that's a problem. So you can take away some of the choice by saying, well, you have a sovereign wealth fund and universal basic services.
I think that's what it'll be.
You know, it's not like, you'll just get internet and power and water. Like, you can get utilities and things, and they're just part of the deal.
Yep.
You know, and so, and that's a little easier to understand that, like, well, if you want more than that, then you can go and produce in a way that the economy rewards you and you can have more than that. But we do have the ability to kind of have really basic levels of like food and shelter. We have enough wealth to do that.
Well, yeah. If things go the way that they should.
Well, certainly the way that they're sort of pushing for that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, it's interesting to me because the social trends, the government trends, the technology trends and how they kind of compete with each other, right? I mean, AI is sort of destroying some of the things that the social safety net may have even tried to create in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now that you have satellites that can deliver internet all over the place, do you have the same need for towers everywhere and, you know, terrestrial infrastructure? Like, it changes
the
game.
It does. I mean, AT&T, or not AT&T, but T-Mobile and Apple have partnered up on beta trials of using Starlink to do sat phones for just the iPhone, you know. And what happens if you don't need a cell phone tower anymore? All those people that were, you know, repairing those and installing those.
Well, I'm not making recommendations here, but I would say Garmin stock doesn't look as attractive.
Didn't Warren Buffett just buy a ton of Garmin?
I have no idea. But if you consider that one of the big things that Garmin does is provides GPS for aviation, and they have satellite tracking and communication devices for off-grid stuff. You're like, well, if your iPhone just became capable of replacing your personal Garmin device, that's a whole channel that's no longer part of Garmin's ecosystem.
Yeah.
So, creative destruction all the time. Right?
Absolutely.
So, all right, well, you know, I see through the eyes of business. It does change things. How do you think this plays out for investors with if the government's going to try to be, I guess, try to create sovereign wealth, or it's going to try to act more like a business, it's going to change the way it holds dollars accountable in the system.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean for investors?
It's a pretty loaded question.
Well, it is an investment show, right?
So, do you want to tackle that?
Well, let's do this. For our listeners, we got to take a break. So why don't we do that? On the flip side, we will come back and let's talk about if the government's going to operate more like a business, what can that mean for us as investors? And what might that change for us? Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Show, where we are talking about the government acting different these days. right? And it's new. Who knows? I mean, once the court system gets involved, I mean, I suspect things will, you know, gradually slow down here in the coming weeks and months just because there'll be a lot of bureaucracy that gets thrown full force at this thing. As a total aside to this, Matt, I have found it really interesting because there's a whole group of folks that don't want to see what's been uncovered, so they shout about how it was uncovered. As if the fact that I get like it doesn't count if you uncovered it the wrong way. And I'm like, so if you find a bunch of like egregious waste, but you're like, yeah, but you found it wrong. I'm like, that may even be true. I'm not saying it is, but like, let's say that's true. Does that mean we can't talk about the waste that was discovered?
You have to. You have to.
Yeah. This is, to me, the definition of cognitive dissonance, or the definition of gaslighting, for that matter. People yelling about, like, you know, it's an evil person, therefore we can't look at what they found. Like, whoa. You know? It's like, if the serial killer helped you find another murderer, can you not count it because it came from a bad person?
Yeah, some Dexter stuff right there.
Just saying, like, where's the line where it's like, oh, well, if we uncover crime, but we, you know, we don't like the person that did it, it's not a crime anymore?
Yeah.
Like, that's cognitive dissonance, folks. Right. And the way you know is if you would treat it differently if you liked the person than if you didn't like the person, right? Or if it was, you know, if you flipped the roles around and then you were like, well, it'd be okay in this scenario. That's the problem. It's like, oh, so you're a hometown official.
Right.
Got it.
So when we left people off at the break, kind of the big question was asking, like, you know, if the government's going to be run more like a business, how does that translate for the markets? What are some of your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, here's the first thing. I don't know that it could change a couple things for the private sector. Like, let's just propose, and I'm not, maybe it turns out to be right, but let's say that Gaza turns into the Middle Eastern Riviera and it's a development site, okay? Does that mean that they're in competition with the private sector for tourism?
Yes.
Okay, so in that case, the government, it becomes a competitor to the private sector. But the government can have unfair advantages because it controls policy. So there are some dangers there of sort of losing the moral high ground by not compartmentalizing.
There is a danger there. I mean, the government has largely stayed out of private business the best that it can for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, and where the government is involved in private industry is mostly because of natural or beneficial monopolies, right? Like, you don't want 300 different power lines running all over the place. You want as few as possible for a number of reasons, not the least of which is aesthetic, but also because just keeping everything up and working and cooperating. So what do? You have utilities that the government oversees. Right, it doesn't run them, but it sort of regulates them, right? But then you've seen that regulation start to extend to other areas, and so yeah, my concern would be a government that runs like a business that competes with the private sector. Although there are those that will say the government already competes in some areas.
You could make that argument.
Yeah, and so I'm not sure what it changes per se. I think what changes is, where does the money get spent? You know, the government controls massive purse strings. I think about a lot of building projects where there's federal dollars that are used as matching grants to build things.
Yep.
If those pools dry up, then you expect less public infrastructure expanse. Okay, well, maybe that lowers the price of real estate and it makes the private sector more competitive.
Maybe.
Right? I mean, if there's fewer prevailing wage jobs, maybe that puts pressure on wages in construction.
I think it's really, really hard to tell because, you know, you can look at, okay, say everything goes to plan and the U.S. does control that space and we start building a bunch of infrastructure, right? You would expect the industrials to do well. Right. But we're also talking about trying to acquire TikTok. So it's like, well, that's something completely different. You're buying a tech company. And so now, you know, you've got a need for more workers in the tech industry. So it's so hard because I think once you go down that road of like, well, we're going to acquire this tech company or, oh, we're going to start building over here. Like, at what point does that stop? Right, because you're going to end up just working your way into all the different, you know, sectors of the market.
Yeah, I have to say, without doing any research on this, but let's use TikTok as kind of a case study. I am inherently skeptical that the government can either A, pick a private market party that has the right to buy this, or B, take it over and run it itself, where it will then compete with the private sector for other social media positions. So it seems to me like the government, really its role is to either say, you either follow the rules that will allow you to operate as a foreign entity operating in the United States, or you don't, in which case you cannot operate here. But the idea that we will force liquidate a company and in order to stay here, a majority of it has to come here, and then the government. So here's where I'm just generally opposed to this. I just am not okay with the government picking winners and losers, right? If it is attempting to make the playing field as fair as possible to everybody, I'll at least give it the benefit of the doubt. But if it's picking winners and losers and saying, well, that, I just think there's an inherent problem there. Because now the government gets subjective control over things.
It's a slippery slope.
Very. And I think we have seen that occur over the last several decades, right? And that's not pointing at any single administration, but you've just seen more and more reach by the government. You know, more and more social engineering. It's not just like fire and public safety and that kind of stuff. It's, you know, getting into, well, you know, the soft subjects of education and, well, what should we be teaching and shouldn't we be teaching in areas beyond mechanical skills that are necessary? You know, and it gets gray in a hurry.
It does.
So,
but the other flip side of the coin is we've gotten ourselves in a pickle. Like, we've really kicked the can down the road for a really long time. And the question is it sustainable? And if the answer is no, then the question becomes, what do you do? And it's like, drastic times might have to call for drastic measures. And I think that's kind of where we're at. And I think that's why we're seeing what we're seeing. The voters basically said, you know, we want to see action and we want to see something radically change. And so here we are.
Here we are. Well,
it's neither right, wrong, or the other. It's just we're in a situation and we have people trying to solve problems. And the reality is when you have people trying to solve people problems, you're going to get people results and they're flawed.
And you're going to get disagreement, right? Because
100%.
Some of these are subjective in nature and we're not going to agree. I think the interesting, maybe I didn't answer the question well when you said what's going to happen for investors. And the first thing was, well, maybe there's going to be competition. But let's just talk about the big economic question, right? You know, does it drive does it make the economy go into recession? Does it make the stock market go down? And we don't know the answers to those. But I think the answer is it's possible, right? Like, it's possible that when you start to really change the structure and operation of government, and you change, you're not talking about moving little bits of money anymore. I was reading that Doge has supposedly found over $2 billion in potential services thus far. And I know the government is, you know, so the $2 billion is nothing actually in the pool of this.
Right, it's like a little
drop
in the hat.
But the plan was to save $1 trillion or more. Right,
that's
$1 trillion
type of number
should move the needle. Right, and so if you see $1 trillion worth of cuts, I would expect that the economy would notice it.
Right.
Right. And I think a lot of it's going to get noticed in, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to hold the thought because I'm looking at the clock. I think the thing you will most notice, you want to know what it is? You have to wait till after the break. Cue the music. Oh, really? Oh, look out. Well, okay, I'm just going to tell you then. Never mind. We'll go to break later. You'll see it in government employment.
How so?
There will be a lot less of it.
You think there's going to be a lot less government employees?
I think so.
I mean, yeah.
So there's kind of a, it's a little bit of a dirty secret about how you can cook the books economically. So this one, I'm going to just say, all right, Kyle, we're going to go to break, because when we come back, I want to talk about how government employment affects a major economic indicator that can make you believe that things are better than maybe they are. But we got to grab a break. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth on News Radio 92.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the home stretch of the True Wealth Show, where we are talking to investors today about what might things look like if our government was run more like a business than it certainly has been in the past. Right? And that's the working theory that we're operating on today. Trump wants to run this thing like a business. Matt, I have a question for you.
Okay.
And it centers around the concept of government jobs. Right? I posed in the last segment the theory that we could see a lot fewer government jobs. Okay?
Right.
And the reason I have this theory is some behaviors that I am seeing out of the Department of Government Efficiency and what Elon Musk and his team have been investigating.
Right. And they've already had a lot of people voluntarily quit.
Right. So I want to come back to that point, but let me ask you a question. Is it possible, or do you see any indications that we may be in a phantom recession?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very possible just from the standpoint that the government added so many jobs over the last 4 years, right? Like, if you look at the numbers, they added on and they added on and they added on. And so your unemployment rate, when you do that, looks different than it maybe truly is. And especially if we're going to see a lot of people leaving those jobs, which we already have kind of started to see that. And so are the GDP numbers kind of cooked? I think they could be. I think that it's really hard to trust data anymore, though, just because it's become so easy to manipulate. And so I think time will tell, but I think we're going to know after the fact, right? Like, I don't know that we're going to catch it in time. I think that if there has been some sort of recessionary pullback or anything like that, I think you're going to know about it after it's already happened and we're already kind of on our way out.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, think back like a year ago. How many articles did you see on a headline? It's like, are we in a recession? And then no one had an answer to that.
Yeah. Well, and then you kept looking at GDP and saying, well, if our GDP is still going positive, then apparently not.
I think the thing that makes me kind of think that GDP is still okay is, you know, you also got other indicators, right? And, you know, you can look at all these other indicators that also show that the American consumer is still strong. And so it's like our goods and services might be actually decent because the American consumer is, they're not delaying gratification. They're just continuing to spend. And you, if you look at the credit card usage, it's like, well, those numbers are astronomically high. So it's like, yeah, I might be kind of prone to believe the GDP numbers just because the American consumer is largely dumb.
Sorry.
Like, you just bought a $95,000 truck. That's largely pretty dumb, right? Like, how can you justify that value? It's like, oh, you just bought a $500,000 house at 7% interest. And gave up your other, that, well, that was probably pretty dumb. Like,
my impression of the American consumer at large, and I'm really, I love the fact that the people that listen to our show,
they're not dumb.
They're not dumb, right?
No.
So these other people we're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think they're just really short-sighted. It's like, it's very instant gratification. There's not very much long-term thinking at all.
Right.
You know, and so long-term thinking is like, wait, a month from now? You know, these are folks that, you know, they don't plan for the future significantly. And it's just, well, if I have the money, I spend it. And I've seen this in a lot of folks. It's dangerous, too, because, you know, I've seen folks that, well, they had business owners. Well, the money was there, so I spent it. And then it turns out that there were other obligations that they didn't know they had. And then they spent the money. And then the other obligations showed up. And then they were financially hamstrung.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, now what?
Yeah.
Right? And so it's really fascinating to me to see how folks don't plan for contingencies very often. And you know, you could say, oh, it's a rainy day or whatever. No, I'm talking about you don't plan for like an accident or something unforeseen. You don't keep anything back in reserves. Right. And it's like these are the people that apparently are also like they're OK driving with the warning indicator when they're out of gas. It's like, well, the light's on. It's like, well, we'll get there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, OK, you are like riding on empty. No reserves. I don't want to be like that, right?
Yeah.
You know, no. It's funny that, you know, you just got back from Hawaii. My understanding, that I believe most planes can fly all the way to Hawaii and turn around and fly back.
Just, yeah.
They carry enough fuel that if they had to, they could fly back because there's not really a good diversion place from Hawaii.
Nope.
So that's the kind of thinking. It's like, well, we have to be prepared for, like, we got there and the runway was broken, so we had to be able to fly back.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah. Just kind of wild. But
yeah, it is.
Yeah, the American consumer, it's a tricky one, right? I don't know that we're in a phantom recession. I don't know, but I ask the question because I just see what's happening here, and I wonder, like,
I think that we will see it. I don't know that we've seen it yet. I think what the consumer's done is they've done what the government's done. They've kicked the can down the road. And at a certain point, there's a reckoning. Like, you can only max out so many credit cards, and you can only make so many bad financial decisions before the house crumbles. And, you know, the new trend is get a HELOC, take a home equity line of credit and pay something off, or, you know, go have fun with it. And, you know, it takes time for the house to fully crumble.
Yeah.
But you better believe that it's going to crumble for a lot of people. And when it happens on a large scale, that's when you're really going to see it. And it's going to be ugly, right? Like, look at where we're at right now. Things are at all-time, like, expenses. Like, stuff is very, very expensive right now.
Yeah.
And it's like, you've bought yourself time. But what happens when you run out of time? You're going to crumble at the worst possible time in history, and a lot of people are going to get wiped out. So I think it's coming. I don't think it's here yet. When it's here, you're going to know it, and it's going to be felt in a big way.
I think there's some real deflationary stuff that's on the horizon if we bring down the price of energy significantly. But I think if you end up seeing lots of government jobs shut down and lots of government spending turned off, that is going to suck money out of the system. Now, on the flip side, if the American consumer, it does lower labor costs, right? Because there's more competition in the labor market. That's not good for incomes.
No.
Right? It's not good for incomes.
No, it's not.
Initially. But it is good for getting the prices of goods and services to realign. And we've talked on this program before about some of the structural problems, right? That it's just too expensive for certain things right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too expensive. Like, housing is out of alignment with the cost of things. And, you know, millennials and Gen Z are feeling it way more than, like, boomers, for example, right? You just look at the percentage of income that has to go toward housing. The costs of trying to live and have a family are just astronomical as a percentage of income compared to previous generations.
Mm-hmm.
How do you address that? There has got to be some changes that allow for more affordable housing, right?
Yep.
And the solution is not give everybody extra money on a mortgage, right? Because that doesn't bring the price down. That lets people throw more money at the expensive thing. The answer is looking at why things are so expensive. And I do think that that is something that a government running more like a business may actually do,
mm-hmm.
right? The input costs of things. And so We shall see. I'm not convinced that it's going to work, but I'm convinced what we were doing wasn't working.
Right.
And so, all right, we're going to take a shot at something else.
Yeah.
So, bottom line to me is this. Until capitalism itself is removed from the equation, I think that the system solves a lot of problems for itself. Capital is very creative. And so unless it loses the ability to make decisions, right? And so it sounds weird like I'm talking about capital like water or something, right? But in a sense, the system, if you close a door, a window opens. Like it invents new ways to be profitable. It figures it out, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you take that away, that's when the problems really start.
Yeah. Okay?
Otherwise, yeah, we may take our medicine. It's no fun. Right, you're talking to a guy that's been through 250% market crashes in his career. So, you know, at this point, I'm not advocating for it at all. But I'm saying both times the market's recovered. Okay, I hope we don't have to take that kind of medicine. But if we do, you know, certainly from our perspective, we better be prepared to figure out how to navigate that.
True.
Right. But if it does happen, there will be opportunity. Rest assured, there will be opportunity. Anyway, as I look at the clock here, we're kind of reaching the end of this. This is probably the part where I tell you, if you are worried about what's going on in the markets, if you are trying to figure out how might you reposition investments to be more conservative or whatnot, there are things you can do. And since we cannot give generic advice on the radio about how to do that, instead, I would invite you to call us. Matt, how might they do that?
Yeah, 541-375-0898.
Right? Check out our webpage. Lots of ways to reach us. You can text that number as well, and we can get you plugged in. And like I said, it costs nothing to get a second opinion, right? So we're happy to do that for you. But there we go. We got the music playing. So we have got another Tuesday in the books. We got to rock. So until next time, I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you've been listening to The True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.